are listening to Bicycle Retail Radio, brought to you by the National Bicycle Dealers Association.
Welcome to Bicycle Retail Radio, the bicycle industry podcast that brings retailers, vendors, advocates, thought leaders to the mic for honest discussions about the latest issues facing retailers while taking an in-depth look at the person within the profession. I'm Heather Mason, MBDA president, and today we are spotlighting one of our MBDA retailers. The conversation today is with Stefan Root and Jaron Pearson, the co-owner and manager of Berkshire Bike and Board with three locations in the Northeast. You are going to learn a lot over the next hour. We touch on retaining the mom and pop feel within your store while running a well-oiled machine, how a detailed structure helps all areas of operations, placing the right person in the right place, and how important it is to get every customer that comes in the door to experience the joys of an e-bike. All this and more, filled with optimism and a bit of apprehension as we enter into 2023. You are going to like this one. All right. Hello. Welcome, Jaron and Stefan. Thank you for coming on the podcast. Really looking forward to the conversation. I want to get into so much recent store expansion. You're in our P2 program, which is great. And I would say neighbors of mine, you know, kind of in the backyard. How are you guys?
Doing good.
Yeah. New year, right? Like right here, 2023. Any resolutions over there? Do you guys do that sort of thing?
Personal or business?
I guess we have to set both of them, right?
We're setting them.
It's a great time of year to think about the past and reflect forward. Yeah, thanks for coming on the podcast. Let's just jump in. Berkshire Bike and Board, you know, like I said, in my backyard, I think 45 minutes from where I live. I was just actually out there on Greylock doing a snowboard a couple of days ago. I thought about popping in. But as we were prepping for the podcast, Jaron, you described the shop as Berkshire Bike and Board is a mom and pop bike shop trying to become a well-organized machine of a business, while at the same time still keeping that feeling of a mom and pop shop. Tell me more.
Okay. That is the best way I can describe Berkshire Bike and Board in the last few years here. I started working here 5 years ago. I'm going to pick on Stefan a little bit probably throughout this podcast. He would be sitting in his office that had, like, you know, there was stuff everywhere. The shops were kind of messy. It was dark and gloomy upstairs where the office was. And he would look at me and be like, we got to write SOPs for this business because we're going to scale it and blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, we're far from that. But the enthusiasm has always been there. And so the easiest way I can answer that question is, like, if you're watching television and Visa does a commercial that highlights a small business, it's always a bike shop. You know, it's a bike shop or a coffee shop. So we are like the quintessential small business. That being said, small businesses, I think, struggle with certain things. And we have realized that if you want to struggle with those things a little bit less, you have to scale your business a little bit. You know, there has to be some more cash coming through the door so you can take care of some problems. So, like, if there's a sliding scale and one end is corporate, whatever, and the other end is like mom and pop sole proprietorship, we've slowly kind of slid that towards more professional business model. That being said, continually like looking around and making sure that we're not losing like the integrity and the culture that is Berkshire Bike and Board, which is fun at the end of the day.
Yeah, I love that. And as an outsider looking in, you know, your locations, Great Barrington, Pittsfield, Hudson, I mean, they each have their unique individual charm and they do have that community mom and pop vibe. But getting to know both of you through our P2 program, I know that this well-organized machine that lives behind that. So I definitely see what you're saying there and congratulate you on being able to achieve both. The three locations, so just this past June, expanding to Hudson. Stefan, can you give our listeners a bit of the background just on Berkshire Bike and Board and how you got to where you are today?
I'll give you the shorter version, which is we have three locations. Like you just said, we started in Great Barrington, where I started working in 1995, and then had the opportunity to buy the shop with my current business partner, David Clark, in January of 1999. ran the shop, you know, as, you know, two business owners and started stepping on each other's toes, realized we both needed to expand a little bit and grow. And there was an obvious market further north of us, which is about 35 minutes, which is the city of Pittsfield. It's our big city, if you want to call it, a city of 42,000 people, a big city in our rural area we're in. We opened that store in 2013. You know, began to realize that as we grew and then the pandemic really fueled to the fire, so to speak, we realized that we wanted to continue to grow. And the next obvious spot was Hudson. So three locations, and yeah, that's where we're at now. That's the real short version of Berkshire Bike and Board and where we're at.
Short but big, right? I mean, and both of you have different roles. So Stefan, your owner, and Jaron as a manager. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about those roles, how you interact? I mean, it seems like as I know you both, you work really closely together, but what's the staff look like that make up the three locations?
Well, that's actually been a nice part about growing is that instead of wearing every single hat, which I used to do, I've been able to focus more on the things that, you know, bring me joy and happiness in my business. And so I've more focused on growth, expansion, but also I'm still a player in most of the running the business, but I don't have to do the day to day, but I still have an integral role in the marketing, which is a part that I enjoy. And I'll let Jaron explain what he does, which is basically runs the show.
I try to run the show, and I'll say that I listen to a lot of podcasts, and you know, whenever I listen to podcasts, I'm always like, how the hell do they do all that kind of stuff? How do these people know exactly what they're doing? And everything sounds so nice and tight. And I'll say that we work really hard here. Everyone is giving it 110% pretty much all the time. We may sound like we know what we're doing a little bit here and there, but at the end of the day, Peter Henry gave me probably my favorite quote for this kind of thing. It's like, you know, are your pants made out of Kevlar? And basically what that means is like, you know, we do financial projections, we do buying meetings, and we run service department trainings. And then at the end of the day, something happens and we make decisions by the seat of our pants. You know, that's really what it comes down to.
We're flying by the seat of our pants.
That's the one.
We're trying to make our pants Kevlar.
Yeah. That's how it goes. Something like that.
Peter Henry of Landry's.
He's a great resource, but it is true, you know, as an owner, if you were just operating the store by yourself, Stefan, you're taking on all these different roles. It's almost too much to be great at every single thing. And it's important to have a team, and seeing Jaron as your manager and the way you work together, really, you lend ideas to each other. I mean, how often are you meeting together? I feel like you're always working as a team.
No.
No?
Monday morning from 9 to 9:45.
Really? And then everything, just the magic happens. So you're detailed, you're planned, you make a plan for the week, and then you guys go at it.
It's not exactly correct, but we sit next to each other. So we're constantly yapping at each other and bouncing ideas. But yeah, no, we do have structure, and I'll let Jaron explain the structure.
The biggest thing that we had to fix before we were ready to kind of try to scale a little bit and open a shop or two was to work on communication amongst the different players in the business. Because you know, if you change something in the buying department, or if Stefan and I maybe make a decision on a policy, that ripples across the service department, the sales department, the buying department, marketing, you know, whatever. So we're in a place now where, like, I think we all feel like we could probably scale to 5 or 6 stores without having to change much, like managerially or operationally, not to hire like really any more leadership type staff. And basically what that is there's like, we have it broken down into like 5 departments: leadership, which is Stefan, Dave, the other owner, and myself; management, which is store managers. I run a meeting with them every morning from 9 to 9:45, or every Tuesday morning from 9 to 9:45. Stefan, Dave, and I meet Monday mornings, 9 to 9:45. What else do we have?
Wednesday service.
Service department, which is service writers and myself. Now it's going to be like a service department kind of lead, basically 9 to 9:45. Buying team, which is basically myself. Stefan and Dave like to be a part of that one a lot. And a guy, Nick, who does the actual purchasing and like making the POs Thursday morning, 9 to 9:45. And then we sprinkle the marketing thing in there, which I would love it if it was Friday morning from 9 to 9:45. But right now it's Monday afternoons from 2 to 3 o'clock. And that is pretty much how all the communication goes. And then, you know, from there, store managers spread the message out to their staff, right? I can't manage 50 people, but I can keep tabs on 5 of them.
I love how you just went into so much detail, and for our listeners, you know, you're hearing the 9 to 9:45 specifics, And I think that's what it takes. You have stuff on the calendar. You're very specific and looking at the operation as a whole and how you're going to communicate that message. And it could be on a large scale when you have, you know, 50 to 100 team members. It could even be if you have four team members, but the idea is to have a plan in place, which it sounds like you're really running that machine. I did jump ahead a little bit. I don't even know how you found cycling and then how you found your way to owning a shop. Stefan, what was, you know, how'd you find the sport and then eventually the shop?
Well, this story's a little bit longer, but I'll also try to keep this one short. I've been an avid cyclist since learning how to ride a bicycle, found mountain biking. I grew up in an area that was rural. So as a kid growing up mountain biking, I used my bike as transportation and loved it. Went to college in Vermont, where I joined the mountain bike team, which introduced me to racing and, you know, starting to learn to work on my bike. And the first summer, my first spring break coming back to our town, I found out there was a bike shop opening in our town. I'm like, that's the coolest thing ever. And one of my buddies was like, yeah, you should go apply there. They need people. So I basically went up to the door. They weren't open. There was a guy in the back pulling bikes out of boxes. I knocked on the door. I'm like, are you guys hiring? They're like, yeah, we're hiring. We're looking for an apprentice bike mechanic and salespeople. And at that juncture, I'm like, oof, I don't want to talk to people. I don't like talking to people. I'm like, I like the idea of an apprentice bike mechanic. So applied for the position. I got it. And I worked at the store summers from 95 until I graduated in 98. My plan was to work the summer, save up some money, and then move to California with my girlfriend at the time. And in August of that summer, 98, the owners came to us and said, hey, we're moving to Hawaii. Do you want to take over? And at that point, they had just hired Dave, my now current partner, as the manager. And they said, we're going to give you guys first right of refusal. And it was a really tough decision for me because growing up in small rural America as a kid, you hate it. You know, like it's the worst place to be. Like you want to get away. You want to go to someplace that's cool, that there's more people. And, you know, it was an internal dilemma that I had to battle with. But I knew it was an opportunity that, you know, doesn't come across often. So I committed to taking that opportunity. Dave and I went, we put a business proposal together, went to the bank. The bank said, okay. And the rest is history. We took over January 1st, 1999. And yeah, so.
And it's 2023. That's how old he is.
I've been in this business a long time.
I love that story. Where is the person who moved to Hawaii? Like, do you still, is that?
Yeah, they managed to stay in Hawaii for 5 years. The island fever is real. They couldn't hack it. They moved back to Connecticut. So it was a husband-wife duo. He is a nuclear engineer for Lockheed Martin. And she, that point, didn't really have a job. She was a city planner. She was, you know, educated, but she needed something where she could, you know, be around her kids. And so he got a job offer in Hawaii, and that's why they moved. But, you know, for a long time, we'd see him, you know, once a year, maybe once every other year, they'd come in and check in on us and see how we're doing. And now they're in Virginia. And
yeah, they must be just so thrilled to see how well you've done with the store and expansion. So that's a great story. But Jared, how about you? I'm assuming you're different. But
I'm different. Steph and I are different.
Just a little.
I'll keep it short and sweet, but it'll be something like, you know, you asked us about this via email. It's like, I worked in restaurants from like 17 to 26 or something like that. I looked up one day when I'd been in there for like 10 or so years. You know, no college, pretty much high school dropout. I had no clue what I wanted to do with my life. I looked around at everybody else that was working in restaurants. They all seemed pretty unhappy. And I was like, damn, am I going to do this for the rest of my life? Like, it didn't look good. So I pretty much promptly quit my job. I had no idea what I was going to do. So I had no job, no money. I was not like saving for my retirement during my years at the restaurant. And I had always been a bike rider. I grew up racing mountain bikes. I got really into like BMX and that kind of skate park culture for probably from 17 to 23. I had bought a mountain bike again, but was like maybe riding it once or twice a week. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to get a job at this little bike shop and just kind of use it as a place where I can collect myself a little bit and figure out what I want to do next in my life. This story always comes to mind. Stefan doesn't interview people really anymore, but he used to ask this question, which was like,
what makes you awesome?
What makes you awesome? And I was like, oh my God, I don't know how to answer this question at all because I am not feeling awesome right now. Ask me now. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah, I don't know. It just, they took me in. They took a chance on me. And you know, I've been working hard here ever since. And I really don't tell Stefan this, but I have no plans on going anywhere. So that's my story.
Oh, I love that. Thanks for the real share there. That's really, I mean, we were just talking a minute ago, joking a little bit about Stefan, how long it's been. I mean, how the past couple of years, I mean, how are you feeling about owning a shop today? And are you glad you made the decision that you made?
You asked us this question in a P2 meeting, and I think just to answer it succinctly, it's apprehensive and optimistic. So I'm optimistic of what the future holds, especially where we are organizationally. I'm excited to move forward. I'm excited for what's to bring, but apprehensive to the fact that our industry is evolving tremendously. We have, you know, threats coming at us from all different angles, and, you know, nothing that anybody listening to this podcast isn't, you know, astutely attuned to. So yeah, it's mixed emotion. Hindsight's 2020. I look back on that decision in 98 and I couldn't be happier. I get to come to work and do what I love. You know, I'm the master of my own destiny. I get to choose my hours to a certain degree. You know, if I need to take time off now that I have children, I have that opportunity. You know, coming to work is fun. It's different every day. I love owning a bike shop. It's fun.
Yeah. Optimistic and apprehensive. I think a lot of us can relate to that. And it goes back to running that well-oiled machine right now. I keep stressing back to basics for this year, really dialing in our operations. It's going to be really important. Let's switch over and take a deeper look just at Berkshire Bike and Board. So for our listeners, if you go online, it's berkshirebikeandboard.com. Great website, lots of stuff going on there. Diving into the name, for me, it makes me think we can get some snowboards or skateboards or something. So do you sell more than just bikes?
Sort of, yes. We were Berkshire Bike and Blade when we started. We took over a bike shop and an inline skate business. And as we all know, that business completely fizzled. And so in 2006, when we built our building, bought property, we decided it was time for a name change. And we'd at that juncture, you know, we knew that our industry is a challenge because we're seasonal. And so we needed to offset some of that cash flow needs with winter business. And both myself and Dave were both, you know, skiers and snowboarders. And snowboarding was a lot easier to get into. It required no fancy mounting. The infrastructure to become a snowboard retailer was really easy. So we became a snowboard retailer. In 2006, we changed the name to Berkshire Bike and Board. But that was kind of the beginning of the end of the snowboard era. We seem to be picking up these trends as they're on their taper. So snowboarding, if anybody's, you know, not been paying attention, has, you know, used to be what the cool kids did, but skiing became cool again, twin tips. And so a lot of people were not picking up snowboarding like they once were. And so there was a lot of, you know, basically it became harder and harder for it to be profitable. And you start doing some math at the end of the year and you're like, why am I doing this? I'm doing this to lose money. It doesn't make sense. So we basically kind of phased away from it. We've always continued to do, you know, some winter apparel, gloves, hats, goggles, winter helmets, you know, some outdoor winter apparel. But pretty light, you know, gloves and you know, snow pants for that person, because we're on the way to a ski area, so we get a lot of drive-by. It's something now we're back in the world of really trying to figure out what is something we want to do to offset our winter business. And I'm still very apprehensive of the ski business because winters keep getting shorter and shorter. We're recording this. It is January 5th, and it is almost 50 degrees. Where it would normally be well below freezing. So our skiers are struggling right now. And so I'm a little nervous. If anybody has some great ideas out there that they want to email us, I'm all ears for alternatives for, you know, seasonality in the bike business. You know, what are things that dovetail really well with the bike shop? And, you know, we've you know, started to really dig deep into what we can, because there's 4 months of the year where we're not profitable. And, you know, we have to really tighten our belts and hunker down, and we managed to make it through.
Yeah. I love the fact that you looked at the numbers and you did what was right for your business outside of the fact, because it was in your name and you felt like you had to keep doing it. Being able to make those decisions, those hard calls, is really important in business. And it is like there's trends and there's cycles. And so now you're looking at it again and trying to strategize, and the call out for help there is real. So if anyone has any ideas, we'll share your contact at the end of this podcast. All right. So getting over to bikes then, would you share some of the brands you carry?
I want to answer the name thing just in one sentence, which is what I tell people all the time because we get asked this a lot. As I usually say, you know, names are hard to change. If we were to change it, we weren't sure what we would change it to. And I got a Monopoly board upstairs that I'll sell you if you want. Bike and board. Brands, you know, it probably is, we're in transition, I guess is a way to say it. No pun intended, because we're trying to bring them in this year. As far as bike brands are concerned, you know, we put a lot of eggs in one basket. We were a pretty heavy specialized dealer for the last 3 years. I'll say it worked really well for us through the pandemic. You know, there's no question they were able to get us inventory. They were able to get us high quality inventory. That being said, you know, we know that any business, whether you're a, you know, a shoe store or a bike shop, you can't have all your eggs in one basket. So we're going to bring in a few other brands, Santa Cruz, Cannondale, Aventon, Electric Bicycles, Borealis Fat Bikes. I think that's everything. Sell the occasional moots. Will that evolve? Yes.
Yeah. So you're consistently reviewing your brand, seeing what's working for your business and making changes as you need.
Yeah. You know, this morning we sat down and we were having a conversation about, like, you know, bike categories and percentage projections for 2023. And, you know, the thing about this business is that those categories and how much we sell in each category is changing a lot. Like, you know, more than 50% of our business is electric bikes right now. So we have to make sure we have enough diversity in those e-bike categories to satisfy that customer who comes in and wants options.
Yeah. And I guess that was going to be my next question. Do you focus on road, mountain, family, a little bit of everything, or...
We focus on everything, but I'd say the majority of our, you know, our floor space and inventory dollars are put towards e-bikes now. It's definitely an emerging market that we embraced. You know, I'd say we were, you know, earlier adopters, not early adopters, but we've been on the, you know, I saw this trend long, long, long ago, and we've leaned into it pretty heavy, but we do sell everything. We'll sell S-Works high-end road bikes. We sell, you know, scoot kids bikes, you know, the run bikes, you know, the occasional trike, you know, we're all mountain bikers. We, you know, we get into full gamut. We basically do it all.
I'll elaborate to that a little bit and say that our Pittsfield location, we sell a bit more full suspension mountain bikes and electric mountain bikes. Great Parenting store is a little bit more road gravel and like comfort leisure electric bikes. Hudson, the new location, you know, we're starting it off. There's not a huge cycling community there. So, you know, front suspension mountain bikes, hybrids, more entry-level price point stuff until we can kind of get some new cyclist activity going in the area. And then we'll probably move up the price point as that happens.
Yeah, I'm glad you jumped in there because that is a question too, like reading, you know, knowing your community, knowing who your rider is and making sure your inventory is well matched. Stefan, you mentioned an expansion in e-bike sales that you're leaning into that. Does that mean that you have a dedicated space on the floor, maybe signage out front? How are you letting your community know that you're the source for e-bikes?
Funny you asked that question. For years, we've had a lawn sign out, or, you know, what someone would, you know, people would call a sign for candidates, or, you know, election signs. Basically, you know, just the corrugated cardboard that says free e-bike test rides. And maybe, you know, if anybody puts that outside their front door, you'd be surprised what kind of attraction that brings to the door. So it drives people through the door. But yeah, we do have dedicated zones in our store that are called out with highlighters and things like that, that, you know, these are all electric bikes. But the electric category now has become so saturated that it's being bifurcated in so many different ways. There's, you know, we have active, we have casual, we have, you know, SL products, we have drop bar, we have mountain, you know, there's so many different angles to it. So it does get a little clustered in the store, but, you know, in like the mountain bike section, there are, you know, high-end analog with high-end electric, but they're separated, but they're in the same zone, so to speak.
Excellent. Yeah, I love the idea that you touched on the test rides. I feel like that's something that I keep hearing, is that having e-bike test rides is definitely an asset to help with sales, increase sales. You expanded this past June. How did you determine that there was a need for expansion? I know a lot of retailers have been considering expansion, especially those with a lot of inventory, just looking at like, okay, I could fill a whole other store right now. So how did you know it was time to expand? What indicators were pointing towards that?
This is during the pandemic when we really started to do that due diligence. And internally, we were, you know, we're growing and we wanted to scale. And the best way to support these ancillary or, you know, the leadership roles is by having, like what Jeremy was saying in the beginning, enough dollars to come through the door. It also gives us leverage with vendors. When you're a little bit bigger player, you have a little bit more power to have conversations, you know, harder conversations with vendors internally as well, you know, trying to, you know, be more professional, grow, be able to pay staff a living wage. You know, this is definitely an internal goal of mine, is to, you know, bring everybody up. And the way we can do that is with growth. Externally, we just did lots and lots of market statistical analysis of the regions of where we're at, you know, also peppered in there with, you know, what is the competition like? What markets are underserved? And Hudson, you know, kept coming to the forefront in a number of different factors. And one of the clinching deciding factors was the New York Times ran a poll of where did people move during the pandemic? And the number one place people moved during the pandemic was the Hudson Valley. They actually called out the city of Hudson, but it's a little bit broader than that. There's a lot of surrounding, you know, rural towns where people were moving because trying to get out of New York City, the Great Migration left New York City. Now, how that's going to affect us long term, because, you know, there is definitely a pullback effect that's happening now. But even if that wasn't part of the equation, it was still, you know, on paper, it makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, and being somewhat local, it's a great area. And, you know, I was very excited to see you expand there.
Why wait to see if they'll come back to your store for service? Why not sell them a plan that keeps their bike working perfectly all the time and brings them back to you every time? Go to nbda.com to learn about our Ride It Daily extended service plans that are only available to NBDA members.
You know, I have a history of running a business with three locations, and I know that presents its own challenges, inventory transfers, just keeping the culture the same. Anything that's surprised you or anything, you know, talking about multiple locations that's been, I don't know, yeah, a challenge or surprise?
I'm going to try to break this habit moving forward of going back to prior questions, but I will say that Stefan's best thing that he did with the electric bike thing is he was able to see the benefit of electric bikes beyond the people who've been riding bikes their entire lives. You know, like 5 years ago, if you asked me about an electric bike, I would have said, I'm not interested at all. I'll never be interested in those. And Stefan realized that there was a whole market of people who would become cyclists if they had a little bit of assistance on an electric bike. So the kind of the unwritten rule at Berkshire Bike and Board, even 4 years ago, was like, if anybody came in to the bike shop, you know, they didn't leave until they took a test ride around the parking lot on an electric bike. And, you know, if Jimmy brings in his high-end race bike, he's probably not an electric bike customer, at least not at that point in time. But he knows somebody who's an electric bike customer. And there's absolutely no doubt if you ride an electric bike, you're going to have a good experience. It's fun, right? We call it like the e-bike smile. Every single time somebody comes back from test riding an electric bike, they're smiling. So Jimmy tells his brother, and his brother tells his parents, and then actually, you know, they're coming in because we put somebody on a test ride. So I have to give a little credit to where it's due there. Scaling question, complications. I think, again, just communication. We're learning, like, you know, you called it out, the 9 to 9:45 thing. Like, you have to be as precise on the little details as you can, because it's like, as soon as that stuff starts to fall apart, everything else is a wash. So just creating structure, like we all kind of live and die by our Google calendars. I like the Google calendars because they're a cheap management software. I know there's a lot of paid ones out there, but Google is great as far as I'm concerned. Yeah, just kind of keeping everybody in the loop is the most important thing. And trying to do that efficiently, because meetings are expensive, right? And we don't ignore that. It's important that meetings are expensive, but like, so yeah, trying to run them efficiently is a constant focus of mine.
Yeah, time is money. I mean, I hope our listeners really heard that one nugget in there, getting everyone who comes in the store on an e-bike. It is so true. We all want to jump on one. We all want the opportunity to try one if we have it. And it's up to your sales team, your staff, to be like that enthusiast person who's like, hey, I know you're just dropping a bike off for repair, but you got to try these bikes. This is a great opportunity. Just take a quick spin. And that can lead to things down the road. So I love that nugget in there.
Yeah. I mean, there's a little bit of a culture in the bike industry where, like, you know, these hardcore bike shops don't want to sell electric bikes to customers. And I always smile when I hear that, because we'll happily take their customers. You know, we want to sell electric bikes.
It's fun.
One of these things too, that we realized early on, there are so many, and there's less now, but originally there was so much misconception around what an e-bike was. And most of what we were trying to do is break down these misconceptions. A lot of people thought, oh, you know, we're 2 hours outside of New York City. And so a lot of people that were coming in, you know, had this perception that it's the delivery guy going 40 miles an hour down the wrong way. That's what an e-bike is. And we're like, that's not what we're selling here. Just try it, get on it. And it was amazing breaking down people's barriers and preconceived notions of what it is or what it was not has been, you know, a huge driver in converting people into being evangelists for e-bikes. You know, our customers are our best salespeople. It's crazy. Once somebody becomes an avid e-biker, you become the talk of the town. And it's amazing. You get pockets of groups of people that come in. One couple made the leap, and now, you know, their group of friends are all coming in and getting on board.
Yeah. I mean, in our terrain, I mean, we're rolling hills. It's hard to take a ride without 1,000 feet of elevation every 10 miles. So having an e-bike is a nice thing. So kudos to you on that. You know, we talked a little bit about vendors the past couple of years just being so hard. I know margins are shrinking. It's something we talk about even in our P2 meeting. It's like, okay, the margins aren't even enough to cover our operating expenses. So what are we doing? What services are we offering to make extra margin? So do you offer fit services, without giving away too much of your special sauce, but focusing on the service department, any pivots you've made in the past couple of years to really try to find some extra margins?
Yeah, for sure. I guess for starting, just to address the fit question, we do fitting. It's something that I started out. I was the fitter, and it's actually something that I've been able to pass off. We hired somebody that actually has, you know, a sports medicine background. We've leaned into retool. We're actually in the process of upgrading our whole space to, once again, be more professional, be more, you know, off the floor, so to speak, where it's got a really dedicated space. So that's definitely a driver. The other one is service. You know, I think too many people in our industry kind of look at service as a necessary evil to sell bikes. And over the last 2 years, we've tried to really put a lot of time and energy and, you know, turning that on its head and making service an actual revenue source for our business. And we've all heard the adage, what gets measured gets changed. And once you start measuring people's performance and sharing that information with them and, hey, you know, these are the numbers that we need to do to be more profitable. And, you know, how long is it taking you to build a bike? And just starting to measure all these things and then communicating with the service people, it's amazing how all of a sudden you can start turning the necessary evil into a real profit center for our businesses.
Yeah, the service department is, I think, one of the biggest opportunities to really increase the revenue coming into our store. And it does, it comes down to measuring the metrics, looking at the data and being honest with your employees. Some great advice there. Anything else that you've done, you know, coming off of COVID, any other pivots that you had to make that looking back now have been really beneficial for your business?
Focusing our buying strategy a little bit more around buying for profitability. Like, you know, we talk a lot about, you know, Joe Schmo with a smart business brand could probably come in and open a bike shop and run it a lot more successfully than the two of us bike enthusiasts, because a lot of times we want to sell the products we want to ride. There's a lot of advantages to that, but there's also some, you know, some difficulties. Like, the really niche, high-end, super cool brands are super challenged. They're like lost leaders on the sales floor. So trying to sprinkle some of that like cool niche product to bring people in the door is certainly still part of the strategy. But then, you know, trying to pivot to some stuff that has a little bit more profitability attached to it is definitely part of the plan for 2023.
Yeah, curating that inventory and looking at what we bring in attached to the margins that we make off of it. That's a great strategy. Yeah, I'm thinking back to the service department too, you know, looking at our service menu, looking at the, you know, the way that we have our service intake set up. Have you made any radical changes to the design or layout of the service center that have, you know, opening a new location, you kind of have a blank slate, right? So is there anything that you've learned along the way when you were setting up a new location that was important to you to capture the additional revenue that the service department can generate?
I think it's a little bit less important on the layout. It was what we've really been driving is having that right person, the right seat is really the driver, really, you know, measuring their attachment ratios and things like that. But yeah, no, we, all of our stores are pretty much matched in that when you walk in, it's really easy to see where the service department is. There's a big screen that has all of the service rates on it. There's all the service writing is done on the sales floor. There's a stand built in so the service writer can communicate with you. And
you said something right there, the service writer.
Sure. Yeah. I said, going back to the last question, like, you know, how do you differentiate yourself? That's having, you know, specific people. And I know as a smaller shop, we didn't have that opportunity in the beginning, but as you start to scale, you can have that service writer who is then responsible for doing all of the service writing and knows the all the things that they need to do to add to that ticket that are appropriate. You know, I have this conversation a lot of times with staff is that, you know, because you're, let's say you're a high school or a college kid, you have this perception that you want to save the customer money. And what I always like to instill to staff is that somebody's made an effort to drive to us, get out of their car, bring their bike in. It's not your job to save them money. It's your job to give them opportunities on all the possible options that they're there. So if you think that most people are coming in the store to get their bike service once a year, or maybe once every other year, it's really important that you're telling them all the potential things that they may encounter, because there's nothing more frustrating than being on the other end of that. And it's like you go in and the service guy's like, yeah, your tubes are fine. Yeah, you haven't changed them in 10 years. It doesn't matter. You know, they're fine. And then you go out and your second ride, you get a flat tire. Who are you blaming? Who are you having a bad experience with? Now, all of a sudden, you're blaming the shop. Whereas if you give the customer that opportunity, yeah, your tubes are 10 years. It's probably not a bad idea to replace them. Tubes do dry out. It's not, you know, super common. But if you want that preventative maintenance, here's your opportunity to do it. And so just having that conversation with service writers and even sales staff, it's the same idea. You want to give somebody the opportunity to say no for all the options that are out there. So if they do buy that new bike and they said, no, I don't want a water bottle, that when they're out there and they're dying of thirst, they're like, ah, I should have got the water bottle. The service guy or the salesperson told me I should have got it, instead of being the other way around.
This question or conversation really is a good example of like that sliding scale between mom and pop shop and then like more organized business. So when I first started working here, like, you know, we had a mechanic at either location. We had two locations when I started. If you brought your bike in, it was like whoever you landed with would kind of service right your bike in a way. You know, more and more we're learning that, especially as bikes get more complicated, that's a skill set. You know, that is a, you have to have a pretty in-depth amount of knowledge to properly service right, spec out the right parts. You know, I cannot service right a bike. I'll tell you that right now. I can take a stab at it, but I'll do a bad job. So just putting, you know, dedicated service writers in that seat, you know, our service guys are pretty much Monday to Friday. Sales staff on the weekends, if somebody brings their bike in for a tune-up, basically they're trained to take the customer's information, you know, tag the bike, phone number, email, you know, forecast to them, here's how our process works, take all the notes, and then they're going to get a phone call by the end of the day on Monday of like, here's the tune-up specs that we think you need by a service writer who can speak to the why.
I love this conversation right now, and I can feel the energy coming off both of you, which is awesome. Stefan, you started that with the right person in the right place. And I think that's so important, because so often we can have amazing team members who we love and their personality is great, but their skill set might not be in the right spot. So really taking a look at each person, and that's an EOS thing, which I want to get to in just a minute. There's another thing, Stefan, when you were referring to helping the riders, you know, giving the rider all the knowledge that we have so they're properly equipped so they can make the choice, okay, I want to get this Presta adapter, okay, I want to get this water bottle cage or whatever. So it's on them, you know, but we've done our job. We've given them all the energy we can put towards them to get them properly set up. Makes me think about the way you work with community. And I know you do a lot with your community. You had a holiday party, which I'm sorry I couldn't attend. I wanted to go so bad. Yeah, I know, I wanted to be there. But I mean, door counts is something I'm hearing. Traffic is down. Any unique ways you're working with your community or working to get people in the store?
Well, we do some of the basics, which is like auto-generated emails where somebody hasn't been in the store in a certain amount of time, it triggers to send them emails. Like some of the basic stuff, we do bi-weekly emails with what's going on in the store to try to bring stuff in. But as far as like working with community, we are super involved in our community. We lead lots of group rides almost every day of the week. There's a group ride going on somewhere. We're heavily involved with the youth cycling because, as we all know, if we don't foster that, there won't be any cyclists in the future. And so we're heavily involved with three local youth cycling groups that are part of what used to be called NESCA. And I don't know what it's called now, New England High School Cycling Association or something. But now it's just saying it's Youth Cycling Association or New England Youth Cycling Association. The name just changed, but it doesn't matter. It's youth cycling. And we also are primary sponsors of a local summer mountain bike race program that has, you know, been met with tremendous success. It's free for anybody to come. There's a Strider race all the way up to basically what was called a four-lap mountain bike, where you get, you know, your Joey pro that shows up who thinks he's the strongest guy in the community. And it gets people from all over. And that's just a few ways that we're getting involved externally externally with the community. But as we scale, we're starting to realize that, you know, doing that for everybody everywhere is hard. And so we're now trying to take our external outreach to social media. We're leaning heavily into YouTube, where people can be part of the shop and know who we are and kind of get that vibe and feel for us. And so we can reach even a larger audience. I don't know if you have anything to add there.
Just, you know, more of the same. Like, we're all bike riders. The vision is to, you know, like, we want to inspire cycling lifestyle people. That's the vision of Berkshire Bike and Board. So the question we've been asking ourselves as we have multiple locations is, like, people want to hang out at the bike shop. You know, they've always wanted to hang out at the bike shops, whether it's ours or another person's. It just seems like a place where people, you know, a lot of bike shops have coffee inside or whatever. And so the question is, like, how do we continue to connect with our customers as we grow and scale? And, you know, the answer to that seems like is YouTube or Instagram or any of that. So we're definitely pivoting into putting a bit more effort into that. And, you know, we're not getting any views or any traction yet on the YouTube channel, but we're having a lot of fun doing it and it's slow. So, to be continued.
Look up our YouTube channel. It's fun.
To be continued. I love it.
Before the miracle happens, right?
Hey, sometimes I feel like it's just throwing things out there and seeing what sticks. I love the youth thing that you're about, you know, getting kids on bikes. I think that's so important. I'm going to hit you guys a little bit off guard here. This is might be a weird question, but you have a very unique business. As I said, I've heard and know about your business because I'm local. But in your eyes, you know, what would you say sets you apart from other bicycle retailers? Why would a local rider choose Berkshire Bike and Board over someone else?
Well, I hope a lot of that's coming through in all of our previous questions, but I think just really, you know, simply put is that, you know, bike shops historically have been an intimidating place, right? You don't go in there because if you don't know the bro culture and you don't know the lingo or the verbiage, it's a scary place. And what we really, you know, pride ourselves on is that, yes, we are all enthusiasts, passionate cyclists that work here. And if you are the guy that comes in that wants to talk about the, you know, the progression rate of your spring, of your rear shock, we can speak to that. But what's more important is that when we interact with our customers, that it's a non-intimidating place and that we speak to people in normal language. We talk, especially when we're selling product, we're talking about the imagery and the benefits, not all the features. The features get lost on 90% of the people. So I'd say that, you know, what sets us apart is that we're very approachable. And yeah, and we have amazing people. You know, I think a lot of bike shops like to talk about amazing people, but I truly feel like we've amassed a really unique group of people. And I'll let Jeremy
I'll say the same thing. You know, we always laugh and say that we're misfits, but we make great toys. You know, that's really, it's the people that work here, want to be here. We'll, you know, we'll have a hole in a, like a position on a, you know, sales floor or mechanic or whatever. And then somebody will come walking in the door and we'll be like, they seem like a good fit. And like not seeming like they're a good fit because they have unique qualities, like some individual character traits about them, some eccentricities, let's call it, ends up we usually finding out it's a perfect fit. You know, besides that, to what Stefan said, I go to bike shops all the time, constantly. I travel a lot. I'm in a lot of different places for a lot of different reasons a lot of the time. And I always go to bike shops. And without fail, I walk into the bike shops and the people who work at bike shops always look at me like, I don't know what the hell I'm doing. And I run 3 bike shops. So it's like, you know, we constantly are instilling with staff, like, if somebody brings in a Canyon, which we cannot sell to a customer, compliment them on their bike. You know, like if you diss their direct to consumer bike, they're never going to come back in again as a customer. But if you talk to them about how cool their bike is and do you like it and this, that, the other thing, build a relationship, maybe they'll buy their next bike from us, you know, or maybe they're going to use us as their service department. So making people feel good is the secret sauce here at Berkshire Bike and Board.
It's something that I've really tried to instill for many, many years. And it started out with, like, you know, the department store bike is, you know, don't make somebody feel bad that their department store bike, because you don't want to tell them that it's a piece of crap. You want to tell them that, hey, you know what, this bike has some limitations. You know, we appreciate that you're here. We're going to do everything we can to get this bike back up and running. It will cost probably more than what you spent on it, which I know is hard to swallow. But if you really feel passionate about this bike, we can do it. And we're now really kind of looking at that same conversation as the, you know, the electric mobility world is exploding with the direct to consumer product. It's the same thing. Having, you know, really sometimes a candid conversation with customers that, you know, as much as I really wish I could solve all your problems, I can't with this direct to consumer bike because I can't get any service or parts for it. But try to be as empathetic is something we really are instilling with our, you know, our staff and our service people, that how would you feel if you were in this position? So really just trying to be empathetic to the customer and not, you know, make anybody feel bad about what they purchased, because, you know, ultimately that's a new potential customer, which we want to have.
So many great things in there. And I like how you guys just pick up off each other and you can tell, like, all the great things that you're doing. I know you're part of our P2 program, and I think, you know, I've shared with you, or I think I've shared with everyone, I like to listen to podcasts. I meditate, I write, I plan, I have a journal, I'm a planner. How do you guys stay focused? You know, how do you keep your visions moving forward? You know, what kind of resources are you guys leaning into to continue to elevate the business?
Stefan's looking at me, so I guess I'll take this one. Again, like maybe 3 years ago, I have to give the Man Group a lot of credit for this. It's a consulting company that we worked very close with over the last few years. You can't really scale your business if that's what you want to do, unless there's a mission behind it. So, you know, the first thing that we really did to kind of lock a lot of this stuff in is we rewrote our mission, our vision, and our values as a team from the ground up. And, you know, basically, like I said before, the vision of the company is to transform lives by inspiring a cycling lifestyle. So essentially, the more we can do that, the better we're doing at achieving our goals. You know, beyond that, there's a lot of smaller nuanced planning that goes into how we execute that. But working on creating that type of language, and we use the language all the time. You know, the values of the business are off the front, dedicated domestiques, and empowerment as action. That is rippled throughout all the conversations that we have internally, but also externally with our customers. So yeah, there's like a little bit of a beating heartbeat of, like, we're trying to do this better and bigger and on a grander scale to serve more people, to share with people the joy that we get from riding bikes, to share that with more people. Like, that's the goal at the end of the day.
Yeah. And local bike stores are so important. You know, I mean, you serve so many people in your community. And I mean, we held a financial forecasting class and you signed up, you came, you know, you call me with questions. So you're continually just pushing that envelope and saying yes to every opportunity. You know, I know we have a lot of listeners who are brands, suppliers, they might be sales representatives. I mean, you have the floor right now. Is there anything that brands or suppliers or reps could do for you that would help you as you, you know, as a business, or could do for retailers at large, in your opinion?
This is something that the industry has talked about forever. And that is, you know, this is part of the work that where we started out after our vision, mission, and values work was really breaking down inventory planning And the whole idea around inventory planning is if you have the right inventory at the right time, you will be profitable. But our business model, basically the vendors to the retailers, that model I feel like is skewed, where the vendors dictate when we get stuff, how we get stuff, when we write the orders, when the season changes. And ultimately, it's not conducive for the retailer, who is ultimately the end user of how that product gets disseminated into the consumer's hands. And so some brands are starting to try to go towards the no model year, or the model year that is not in July, which is, you know, Cannondale, which is a brand that we're working with. But I guess, you know, my advice or ask of the industry is to get away from, you know, huge preseason orders back to just-in-time inventory purchasing. You know, we have to work more closely with our vendors in inventory planning. I'm totally down with that, but it needs to be broken down more quarterly or even you know, monthly, which is how we are now doing our inventory planning, which is, you know, super, you know, valuable for not only us as retailers, but also for the brand. If we can tell our brands, hey, we need this product in, you know, April, May, June, I need this product in July, August, and I need this product in December, then not only they can forecast correctly, but then we can forecast correctly. Instead of taking this huge product dump in the middle of our slowest, the beginning of our slowest season, which is, you know, September, October, November, December, and into January. I know, granted, past couple of years, we haven't really, or, you know, we haven't, and the brands haven't had that system in place because of supply constraints. But as we move forward, as the supply chain, you know, now goes the other direction, I think it's even more important that we get away from product year changes in July, and we really work with vendors to do inventory planning. Because as an industry, we do it pretty poorly. I hate to say it.
Yeah, I could not agree more with you. It's a great time to reset, right? I mean, this would be a great time, given the current inventory situation, to do a reset like that. And if we could get it down to a monthly planning, it'll help everyone at the end of the day. So I love that answer. Okay, I have a couple more questions. We're almost hitting the hour mark. So you've been part of our P2 program in our group one for almost a year now. Just for our listeners, you know, who might be considering a P2 group, why did you decide to join, and has it helped your business?
I want to go back and answer a question that you would ask, you know, like what gives me inspiration? And that is other members in the P2 group. There are some amazing retailers in there that are, you know, basically I look up to, and I aspire to be as great as a lot of them. And that's one of the things that is, you know, drives us forward, is to be better retailers, to be on the same level as some of our peers. And so we've known for a long time, as we grow and scale, that it's hard to do it by yourself. And so we know that with no Interbikes and no dealer events, we lost, you know, one of the greatest assets, which I felt was peer-to-peer connections with other retailers. And like, how can we get that back? And P2 Group is that exact thing, whereas I get to now connect with other retailers that are having the same struggles that we are. We can bounce ideas off each other. I can hear their best practices. They can hear my best practices. And it just helps everybody grow. So I don't want to sound too over it, but it's been amazing. It's transformed our business. It's really helped us grow and be better retailers.
It's pretty cool. In the group, like you're perfect for the group, and the group is, I can't wait. Ohio here in just a couple of weeks, we get together again. So that'll be fun. Okay. Let's close the podcast out. One of my favorite questions to ask, you know, we're giving advice, we're talking business right now, but I'm sure you've gotten your wealth and share of advice from other people as you've gone along over the years. So maybe both of you, best business advice you have ever been given. It's a huge question.
I'm going to call out a retailer that has since retired, and that's Kevin Chudy of Bike and Hike in Oregon. I don't know if you ever had the pleasure of meeting him, but he was a giant retailer. We were a giant retailer. And one of those things where we actually went to Taiwan together. There's a whole group of us that had the opportunity to go to Taiwan, and he could see that I was a struggling business person trying to find my way in the world. And he didn't give me a piece of advice. He gave me a book, and the book is called Working the System by Sam Carpenter. which really started my path down to wanting to be a better retailer. It also coincided with having children, which all of a sudden really gives you a kick in the pants, like, whew, you know, I can't really just skirt along here. I need to make sure that I'm financially viable and sustainable for my children. And it just basically put me on the path of how can I be a better business person? The way I'm going to be a better business person is by creating systems. And that led Jaron to becoming, you know, really integrated into our business and really a part that he really enjoyed. And that also then led us to traction. So another phone call to another one of our fellow retailers, Jamie at Gorham Bike and Ski. And Jaron had said, hey, you got to check out this book. It's a book by Traction. I'm like, yeah, okay, I'll check it out. And literally it was the same week I called Jamie and just, you know, we were having a conversation. He's like, you got to read this book. It's a book by called Traction by Gina Wickman. I'm like, so funny. I just got the book. And this was, you know, maybe 2.5 years ago or 2 years ago, which really sparked us down this road of really systemizing our business, running our business with, you know, a real plan instead of me just trying to do everything and doing it poorly. Now we have it's a roadmap to success.
I love that. And I am a huge fan of Traction. I think I carry it with me everywhere I go. It's something I look at a lot. So Jaron, what about you?
I'll go back to what I said in the beginning, which is like, you know, we were in the middle of building this super complicated, at least for me, financial model with Peter Henry of Landry's. He kept saying, like, are your pants made of Kevlar? Because you're going to be fined by the seat of your pants in this business. And so what that really, like, how that resonated to me is like, you know, I could walk downstairs right now and find a dozen problems that are happening in the bike shop. You know, the floor looks weird over there. This salesperson is texting on their phone instead of wiping down the windows. And, you know, the list could go on and on, but like being comfortable in a lot of that is so important because this is a long-term game. You know, things are not going to be perfect, but if you can kind of buckle up and enjoy the like long-term slow changes, slow growth, I think, I mean, that's how I sleep at night. You know, like I remember times where I would be so stressed about a business that I don't even own. It was like, I got to chill out. Like, this is all going to be fine. And then the other thing that I think we all kind of operate here, which is sounds so corny, is just the golden rule. Like, if we treat our manufacturers well, they're probably going to treat us well, right? If we treat our customers well, they're probably going to take pretty good care of us. If we take care of staff, you know, they're probably going to take care of all of us. So that's pretty much how we kind of run things over here. And it seems to be working all right so far.
I love you guys. You guys are awesome. It's refreshing to talk to two people who I think so highly of and amazed by the business that you've created and appreciate you coming on the podcast and sharing so openly. There's going to be listeners who I'm sure have questions or want to reach out to give some thoughts about off-season, you know, execution. You know, would you share an email address? What's the best way to get in contact with you?
You didn't even ask us who's better at riding bikes, Stefan or myself.
Oh, wait, hold on. I have one more question. Jaron, what makes you awesome?
Holy shit. I can beat Stefan up, down, left and right on a mountain bike trail.
Negative.
That is a fact. Okay, quick tangent here. We raced like a month ago. Granted, it was my favorite trail. And we took like all these hotshot teenagers who think they're the, you know, the bee's knees. Stefan came on his fancy $15,000 electric bike and we raced mountain bikes. And I'm going to let Stefan tell you who beat everybody.
Jaron beat us by 4 seconds.
By 4 seconds.
A win is a win.
A win is a win.
5 minute trail. It was fun. It was a blast. He got lucky that day.
In all seriousness, www.berkshirebikeandboard.com. If you click on about, there's a thing that says the Berkshire Bike and Board team. There's a direct line to Stefan and myself via email right on there. And we would love to hear questions and this, that, and the other thing.
Any feedback would be more than welcome.
You guys, thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, our pleasure. Thank you.
Ohio is coming soon. All right, listeners. Thank you for listening to Bicycle Retail Radio. The podcast is designed specifically for the bicycle industry. If it's your first episode, we urge you to take time and listen to our past episodes. Special thanks to MBDA Development Director Rochelle Scouten for editing and promotional graphics. We appreciate your support. Thank you for listening. And with this, we go.
This has been Bicycle Retail Radio by the National Bicycle Dealers Association. For more information on membership and member benefits, join us at nbda.com.